Between the Keys is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Funding for this program is provided in part by listener members like you. This is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and welcome to Between the Keys. My guest this week is the concert pianist Ben Lawdy, who is the head of piano operations at tonebase.co. He is responsible for producing, directing, and overseeing post-production of in-depth tutorial videos for this innovative website. Tonebase.co is an extraordinary resource for music education, and it's a real treasure trove for anyone who cares about the piano. And it is our mutual love for the piano and its history, its repertoire, and its lives that bring Ben Lawdy to Between the Keys. Welcome back. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, Jed. And my only complaint is that you don't have me on more often.
Well, we really should co-host a show and do this all the time and go on the road. We are going to compare pianists to themselves in multiple recordings that they have made of the same works at different times in their careers. Why don't we start with pianist Carlo Grante? Carlo Grante was the first pianist to record Scarlatti's complete keyboard sonatas on the Modern Concert Grand. And from that complete cycle released on the Music and Arts label, let's hear the sonata in D minor with the Kirkpatrick number 1. We just heard Carlo Grante's 2009 recording of the Scarlatti D minor sonata. Now let's go back to the mid-1990s when he recorded this sonata as part of an earlier attempt to set down all of the Scarlatti sonatas complete. He never finished that first cycle, but the second cycle he did in the 2000s, he did finish. So let's hear that earlier performance now. Thank you. just heard Carlo Grande play the Scarlatti D minor sonata, Kirkpatrick number 1. That's a performance issued on the Dante label from the 1990s. And Ben Lawdy, I'm curious to see how you think the earlier performance compares with the later one that we heard first.
Well, I have to say, what we just heard, the earlier version, I can hear that he's recording this for a box set. And no offense to him, if I had to play 555 sonatas in the same time span, some of my renderings will be digital, monochromatic, fast, and rather neglectful of details, like the second performance was here. This is the earlier one. Now, his later recording, the one that we heard from 2009, I think it's beautiful. It's slower. His timing decisions are more interesting. These little ornaments at cadence points that Scarlatti is so famous for are more thoughtful here. And the silences between the sections are more powerful. And he actually dances in his later version. And he doesn't dance at all in the first version.
I don't know. I like the earlier one because I think it has a sense of scintillation about it. Although I do agree with you that the detailing is a lot more considered in the later one. But of course, another great composer who was born in 1685, besides Scarlatti, was J.S. Bach. And one of today's most prominent exponents of Bach on the piano is Angela Hewitt. She made her first recording of the Goldberg Variations in 1999 on a Steinway, and then she re-recorded the Goldbergs in 2015 on her treasured Fazioli Grand. That was the piano that was tragically destroyed when it was dropped in 2020. Happily, she did find a terrific replacement. I thought we could listen to Variation 18 with Angela Hewitt from the Goldberg Variations in both performances back to back, first 1999 and then from 2015. Thank you. just heard Variation 18 from Bach's Goldberg Variations with pianist Angela Hewitt, first from her 1999 recording on a Steinway, and then from her 2015 recording on a Fazioli Grand. And they're very similar, but they're small refinements, I think, in the later one that I noticed.
In the Fazioli version from 2015, I hear vocal continuity. And what I mean by that is when one voice does something, I continue to hear it speaking or singing with a similar timbre so that I know that this is one voice with one identity traveling through this texture. And it helps me distinguish it from the other voices, and it helps me hear the canon. So I actually hear the polyphony much better in the later recording. In the earlier one, the voices will sort of fade in and out almost sometimes. It almost sounds like the voices are in a library. And every time they rise above a whisper, the librarian shushes them and they have to come back down again. And what it does is it makes it hard to follow the three independent lines. And so to the extent that I value Bach's counterpoint, I value Hewitt's later version here on the Fazioli.
I also think in this case, it may be a matter of the piano, because I think she had lived with this particular instrument for such a long time and was able to really fine tune her articulation. Whereas the Steinway, which is a beautiful instrument, is a little bit more generalized, perhaps. Next, we have an example of the pianist George Bolette playing the same piece, first in a studio recording, and then in a live performance. This is one of Leopold Godofsky's transcriptions of Chopin's Black Key Etude. So let's first hear George Bolette's 1978 studio recording. One of Leopold Godofsky's transcriptions of the Chopin Black Key Etude in a 1978 studio recording by George Bolette. Now let's hear George Bolette and the same piece in a live recording made 5 years later. Wow. What a difference in those performances. We heard George Beaulette play the Leopold Godowsky transcription of Chopin's Black Key Etude, one of his seven transcriptions of the Black Key Etude. Ben Lotti, I thought the later live performance had so much more life and color and animation, although the studio recording to my ears, I think, is very beautiful in and of itself. What did you think?
I completely agree. I was lucky enough to just work with Marc-Andre Hamelin, and I interviewed him a little bit about these Chopin-Godowsky transcriptions, which, of course, he has championed. And one of the weird things about Marc is I think he's one of the few pianists who plays the same way in the recording studio as he does on stage. At least that's what he claims. He says he doesn't feel different either way. And so I think he's a rare case where you might actually hear very similar sounding interpretations between recording studio and the stage. Not so for Beaulette. It's night and day for me. In the studio, it's clean, pristine, it's polished. Frankly, the music sounds a little bored with itself. It's not so free. And this isn't really against Beaulette as it maybe is against the microphone, because when he's on stage, there's so much more direction to the phrasing, more color, more interest in detail. The transitions are more flowing and beautiful. I mean, for me, it's just obvious. This is a live pianist. This is a pianist to hear live.
And he acknowledged that. And in fact, he always encouraged people to bring little tape recorders to his concerts. He encouraged bootlegging, which is very interesting. Not everyone does.
And I would say, given the nature of the music, I mean, I've always heard these as kind of hallucinations on Chopin's etudes. There should be something unrestrained and surprising and fantastical about sound. I mean, they should never sound to the letter. There's no letter of the law here. It's in a total dream world.
In a way, I kind of feel that way about this next piece that we are going to hear. It's the D major prelude of Chopin from his 24 preludes, Opus 28. And what I love about this piece is that it's a very sophisticated kind of study in phrases that are rhythmically displaced over the bar line. And it's kind of difficult purely by ear to determine just where is the beat. Anyway, let's listen first. We're going to listen back to back to Maurizio Pollini in first his 1974 studio recording. And then we will hear his 2011 re-recording of the prelude. Just heard two different recordings of Maurizio Pollini playing Chopin's D major prelude from the Opus 28, 24 preludes. First, from his 1974 studio recording, and then we heard his remake from 2011. I find these totally, totally different.
Why don't you say that? Because I actually hear the same concept for both of them, even if maybe the resulting surface is different. I'm curious to hear from you, Jed. What did you hear that was so different between the
Well,
two?
I feel that he is a lot more patient with detail in that first recording, where you really hear how the phrases are going over the bar line, and there's a variety of articulation that in the second performance, he just seems to barnstorm his way through it. It's a little more impatient, I think.
My problem with the second one is I don't hear him. I hear the same ideas. They're just not rendered with the same amount of clarity and execution. So I feel like if you're going to redo this later in your life, have a new idea for it. You know, if you don't have quite the same digital control, do something different. I felt like he kind of had the same idea about the piece. He just couldn't execute it the way he used to when he was younger. And that disappointed me, actually.
Yeah. Although I do have to say, in his defense, he does have a new recording of the Beethoven Hammer Clavier Sonata. And it's really, really wonderful. We have music of Beethoven next, the first of his 11 bagatelles from his Opus 119. And this recording by Stephen Kovacevich, I think, is from the early 1970s, maybe the late 60s, but I'm too lazy to go check out my physical disc because it's way the heck up on my shelves. But let's listen to this first. Stephen Kovacevich playing the first of Beethoven's Opus 119 bagatelles, and that is from his Philips studio recording. I think that's a very pretty performance. What did you think, Ben Lawdy?
It's beautiful. It's legato. It's pedaled. The voicing is exquisite. There's a gentle sway to the trio section. For my taste, it's a bit smooth, but very deftly rendered.
I kind of agree with you that it is smooth, but let's go to his later performance. I think this is from the late 1990s for the EMI label, and I think it's going to be quite different, but I haven't heard it in a while. Let's check it out. Thank you. Stephen Kovacevic playing the first bagatelle from Beethoven's Opus 119 Bagatelles. That's quite a different performance. It almost sounds like a different pianist in many ways with Stephen Kovacevic.
I like what he does in the 90s version. I guess after 20 years living with the piece somewhere in the back of his head when he brought it back, he realized there's a lot more layers, more voices you can bring out when you have a texture made up more of detached sounds, some more connected, some less connected. It's just a more diverse texture. And the B section had a kind of innocence to it in this later recording that I also really like.
Lots more variety of character. And it almost stands to reason that the second version is more Beethoven than Kovacevic. And the earlier one, it's maybe 50-50. Let me remind you that you are listening to Between the Keys, and this is Jed Disler, and my guest is Ben Lawdy, and we are comparing pianists playing the same works at different times of their lives. Going back to the Chopin Preludes, the second to last of the 24 is in F major, and it's this lovely lyrical piece. And it has a slight surprise at the end when the composer sneaks in an E flat, which is a foreign tone to the key signature. And it's a rather understated kind of surprise. Now, some pianists like to take this piece on the slow side, such as Ruth Slenzinska in her 1962 recording. Let's listen to that now. Ruth Slenzinska playing Chopin's Prelude number 23 that was recorded in 1962. She plays it in a very understated, maybe underplayed kind of way. Usually it's a lot faster and suppler. I don't know what you thought, Ben.
I thought it was very dignified. She wasn't using it as an opportunity to display her right hand virtuosity. If you're playing the whole set, you don't need to use this piece to do that. You've just done it many times and you're about to do it again in the last prelude. So I'd have to hear in context, how does this pacing sound? I bet it sounds nice actually in the context of the whole set.
It actually does. But now I'm very curious, just on a whim, I'm very curious to compare that recording to the one that Ruth Slenzinska made of the same prelude in 2021, when she was 96 years old. I think we should hear that. I'm just curious. Thank you. Ruth Slezinska playing the F major prelude of Chopin. That's a 2021 recording. She was 96 when she recorded that. That is much slower than the other one, I'll tell you.
I have decided that when you turn 90, you get a free pass and you're allowed to play things at any tempo you want. I've worked a few times with Seymour Bernstein, quite the character. This man's in his 90s and he's got a Raindrop Prelude that I think is still going right now. He started it a couple of years ago. No, forget the age, although you can't really forget it, can you? Here she is, almost in her 100th year, taking utter delight with the music, every note, every interval, the freedom of her left hand as it unfolds harmonies, even though it would have been done in a sweep in 1962. Now it's just, everything is just in slow motion, but you can hear this deep appreciation for the music, I think. There's a sincerity to it. You shouldn't forget how old she is here. I think it's part of the aesthetic of listening to this recording, actually. And it can make it more pleasurable to know that someone who's lived a lifetime and is putting a lifetime in each one of those notes is behind the music here.
Ruth Slezinska had piano lessons with this very talented piano player whose name was Sergei Rachmaninoff. And I've sometimes played this next recording on my program, which is the Mendelssohn Spinning Song, which Rachmaninoff recorded in 1928. This is a famous performance, and probably it's best known because Rachmaninoff makes this little pause before the downbeat where the main theme starts, you know. I'm not singing it very well. Better to hear Rachmaninoff play it. Sergei Rachmaninoff playing the Mendelssohn Spinning Song. That is his famous 1928 recording. My God, what authority he brings to this music. Now, what's interesting is that Rachmaninoff made an earlier recording of the Spinning Song using the acoustic process before microphones came on the scene. And this is from 1920. Let's listen to it and compare. Thank you. Sergei Rachmaninoff playing Mendelssohn's Spinning Song, his 1920 recording. And as we were both listening, you did mention, which I forgot to mention earlier, in fact, I don't think I've ever mentioned it, is that he adds little bars of spinning at the beginning, like he needs a couple of extra bars to get going. It's not in the text, but I think it totally works. What did you think comparing both of these? Ben Laudy. I love that first 1928 recording because it has a sternness about it and a backbone that I really kind of dig. But the earlier one seems a little more flexible. I don't know. What did you think?
You know, I wonder, there's 8 years of difference here. And we know what Rachmaninoff was doing in those 8 years. These were some of the heaviest concertizing years of his life. He probably played this piece on stage, you know, not just 8 more times, 80 more times in between these two recordings. And I do prefer the later version. And what I hear in it is there's more centrifugal force. I don't know. The filigree is a little more active. It's slightly more brisk, but there's just more gravity to his spinning. Now, maybe some of that's the difference in the recording process. But I do find the 1920 recording, the one we just heard, slightly dull. And I have to admit, I'm also a little angered by the fact that we're sitting here listening to Rachmaninoff Mendelssohn spinning songs when we could be listening to his Liszt Sonata or his Opus 111. But these things never got recorded for unfortunate events in history. So I'm so glad we have anything at all. But too bad we couldn't be listening to something more majestic.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't know if I agree, because I feel that there's a sense of air in between the notes in the earlier one. I really like both performances equally, and they complement one another.
Fair enough. And maybe he was a little less jaded with the piece when he played it in 1920. And it does have a simplicity to it that's hard to beat.
Our next comparison will be a piece from the piano suite On an Overgrown Path by Janáček. And the name of this piece is called They Chattered Like Swallows. And the pianist whom is most closely associated with Janáček was Rudolf Firkuschny, who actually studied with Janáček when he was a little boy. We're going to hear two recordings back to back. First is the recording he made in 1969 for Deutsche Grammophon, and then we're going to hear his remake for RCA that took place 20 years later in 1989.
Thank you.
We just heard Rudolf Verkushny in two recordings of the little piece called They Chattered Like Swallows from Janacek's Piano Suite on an Overgrown Path. The first performance was from 1969 and the second from 1989. Ben Lotti, what I noticed is that in the later recording, the pianist is a little more observant in terms of honoring Janacek's phrasings and articulations. Like the very opening phrase, for instance, was more detached in the later recording. But then the left-hand counter melody in that middle section was more understated the second time around. And I think in the earlier recording, he projects it and sings it out more.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically reading off my notes here. And in a good way. I think on this one, we really agree. I do like both. They were two different perspectives on the same chattering swallows. He's shining a light on different facets of this really fascinating piece. So I heard similar things. The second one begins more accented, more punctuated. Mm-hmm. Like you say, he's also more subdued in with certain voicings in certain sections. So like the whole counter section in the later recording, he keeps it underneath and he doesn't allow it to get too dramatic. And in the recording, it is more restless. There's more sort of antecedent, consequent counter phrases. And he's really mixing up his approach to phrasing 20 years later.
I agree. I think the later one maybe is more refined in detail, and perhaps it's closer to Janacek's speech singing sound world. But the earlier recording seems to have more character on the surface and contrast and more range of dynamics. So one might say that the earlier recording sells the piece better, but maybe the second one is more of the quintessential Janacek. I don't know.
Maybe he's playing for the audience in 1969 and he's playing more for the composer in 1989.
That's a good way to put it. I just wrote an article for Gramophone magazine discussing various complete recorded editions of the Chopin Etudes. And my top recommendation for some time now has been the 1983 recording by the Cuban-born American pianist Juana Zayas. So I thought we could first listen to her 1983 recording of the C major Etude, Opus 10, Number 7, which is a study in rapid double notes where the right hand consistently alternates between thirds and sixths. Let's listen. Really love that performance. That was Juana Zayas playing Opus 10, Number 7, the Chopin Etude in C major. Ben Lotti, did you like that as much as I did?
I loved it. It's a revelation. It's just bursting with confidence. You don't always hear confident performances, even in great performances of these works. He revealed lines just through subtle changes in articulation and grouping effects that made this piece, which I am deathly afraid of. I've never this piece.
Most of us are.
It's one of these underrated, very, very hard Chopin etudes. It fits a certain kind of hand, and for the rest of us, it's a nightmare. But what she did was really thrilling.
And she plays it with a lot of joy, don't you think so?
It's fast, but not for the sake of being fast.
Now, what's interesting is that she re-recorded all of the Chopin etudes in 2005. So I thought maybe we could listen to her play the same etude in 2005. Let's listen. Juana Zayas playing Chopin's Etude in C major, Opus 10, number 7. That is her 2005 recording. And I don't know. I think it's a little heavier than the 1983 recording that we both adored a few moments ago.
Still very articulate performance. And I would say that one thing has been consistent throughout this episode, and it's not surprising. Later recordings, as a rule, are slower recordings. As you get older, you tend to start playing things more slowly. And part of that makes a lot of sense. You're inside the music, you're appreciating more detail, and it just takes longer to reveal that appreciation for each note. You hear more articulation on individual notes in this later Chopin. But whereas in the Janáček, it was a kind of piece where the music benefits from individual notes being articulated in new ways. Here, I don't think as much. I mean, to show each of these little filigree patterns with high definition, as you hear more in, I think, her later recording, it actually doesn't help the larger flow or phrasing of the piece. So even though it was exquisitely controlled and shaped and still very impressive in 2005, I want to listen to the first one. That's the one I'm going to replay and replay and replay because I was so enamored with it.
This kind of comparative listening really gives me and probably you a lot of food for thought, and as well as our listening audience. And Ben Lottie, I am so happy and grateful that you took time from your busy schedule to join me today for Between the Keys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's really great to be with you.
Thank you, Jed. This is my favorite thing. I think this is really what the core of our art form is about, is rethinking pieces we love and always allowing our interpretations of them to evolve. So to hear great pianists evolve themselves over the decades is quite a treat to listen to.
It's the process that counts. You have been listening to Between the Keys here on the Classical Network. My name is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network. And I look forward to you and I being together next week at this time. Between the Keys is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.